Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alan Fells at Melbourne University, and this session is about cities, and in keeping with the whole theme of the conference, there are many aspects of cities, but we're interested in the link of cities and productivity. And unlike many of the topics at this conference that kind of fit into a relatively rigid disciplinary framework, cities is a much more challenging thing to talk about at an economics and even social outlook conference, and also the governance questions are more complex in many ways than many of the other areas of government policy. But fortunately, we've got a fantastic panel. We're starting rather late because of the Prime Minister's session, so I'm just going to go straight into inviting each speaker to talk for about 20 minutes. And our opening speaker, we're honoured to have, thrilled to have, the Honourable Angus Taylor, who is the Federal Assistant Minister for Cities and Digital Transformation, has been in Parliament since 2013 and is a front bencher. He has a very strong background in business, including at Port Jackson Partners and McKinsey, a strong academic record. And we're very delighted to have you here, Minister.
Thanks, Alan. It's great to be here. Thank you to the Melbourne Institute for this terrific event today and for having me here today. You certainly got a great list of speakers through the course of today, and it's great to be here with John and Sarah, who I know have a huge focus on this area and have much to say. I'm looking forward to the panel with them. Look, I thought I'd just talk for a few minutes today about exactly what Alan was suggesting the topic should be. So I'm answering the question I've been given, which is to focus on the role of cities and productivity. And I firmly believe, as someone with a strong economics background, that the economic infrastructure of the 21st century is very much about cities, and I'll spend a few minutes talking about that. I do then want to talk about how the government is using our policy levers, the policy levers at our disposal at the federal level, where we have not tended to have a focus on cities traditionally, to try and drive that productivity in our cities. And then I'll spend a few minutes talking about a new measurement framework, a performance framework that we've released today, on the basis that what gets measured gets done. And I firmly believe that, and I'll spend a few minutes talking about that measurement framework. But I probably don't need to convince many of you in this room how important cities are to a 21st century economy. And I think more and more we're seeing that cities are more important as a unit of competition than countries. And the role of cities is clearly escalating at a very rapid pace. And we are getting to the point, I think, where we have to start thinking, certainly at the federal government level, of Australia as not just a federation of states and territories, but a collection of cities and regions. And certainly that is the mindset of the federal government. It's why the Prime Minister established a cities portfolio within Prime Ministers and Cabinet, recognising the important role that cities play. I'd also emphasise that I think this focus on cities, even from the federal government level, is an affirmation of a time-honoured conservative principle of decentralisation and subsidiarity. So that's the very simple idea that always worked for me as a management consultant in business, that the person closest to the coalface knows most and knows best about what needs to be done. Now, I unfortunately have come to the view that in recent years, Australia, as with many countries in the Western world, has somewhat lost touch with where prosperity comes from. And this is a sad, it's a tragic story for us economists, that productivity is now seen in many ways as a dirty word. But as Paul Krugman, someone not from my side of politics, has been fond of saying, productivity isn't everything, but in the long run, it's almost everything. And a country's ability to improve its standard of living over time depends almost entirely almost entirely on its ability to raise its output per worker. Unfortunately, in modern politics, I think we're spending a lot less time focusing on how to grow the pie, how to increase output per worker, and a lot more time on making sure that each individual group or individual gets more of that pie. And whilst those equality issues and inclusiveness in our economy are enormously important as someone representing a regional and outer suburban electorate, I don't want to understate the importance of that. Ultimately, it is a lot easier to think about those issues when you have a growing pie. Part of the issue, I think, is that unchecked self-interest is replacing national interest as a focus in much of our policy debate. So as a government, we firmly believe that the secret to sustainable growth, growth that is inclusive, is a growing pie, and that is all about ultimately creating economic and social opportunity. Economic and social opportunity. It's very difficult to achieve that without growth. Now, I also believe that creating that opportunity is central to the social licence that's embedded in our market-based democracy. So this is profoundly important, in my view. And I see, as do all MPs, lower house MPs in particular, don't want to be nasty about upper house MP senators, but the truth is we are faced daily with the prospect of our constituents talking to us about the opportunities they see in front of them. And I have become completely convinced in my short four-year tenure in the Parliament that ultimately economic and social opportunity is central to people having trust in our most basic institutions. So this is extremely important, and as I'll argue in a moment, I think cities are right at the centre of it. Now, it's clear to me that there are untold opportunities for well-educated, outward-looking, tolerant countries like ours. And Al and I were just talking about, before this session, the employment growth that we're seeing in Australia. It's been reasonably strong, and it's been particularly strong in our two biggest capital cities, Melbourne and Sydney, and particularly strong in the central business districts. But that economic and social opportunity needs to be much broader than just those areas. Now, if we look at the history of thinking about productivity in this country, certainly in my lifetime, much of the focus in the 80s and the 90s, that period of revered productivity improvement, Paul Kelly loves to talk about the extraordinary reforms that were achieved during that period, quite rightly, they were very focused on industrial productivity. And I don't want to understate the importance of manufacturing, mining and agriculture. They still matter. In fact, I come from a region where they are still enormously, enormously important to the economy. But we've got to accept they're a much smaller part of the economy than they once were. In fact, manufacturing is about half of what it was as a share of the economy 30 years ago. And, of course, they're being replaced, those industries, at least their ratios are being replaced by services. Obviously, some of those services are market services like communications, transport, entertainment, retail and construction, and they've, all of those industries have been growing as a share of the economy, but also public services, education, childcare, aged care, health, disability are playing an increasingly important role. And when people say to me, all this automation and globalisation is going to put everybody out of work, I say, well, just look at the jobs growth in those service sectors. It has been absolutely phenomenal, and we see that right across the economy. Unfortunately, though, when economists talk about productivity, there's still a bias to talking about industrial productivity. It's easy to measure. We can measure a widget. We find it much harder to measure a unit of entertainment or other service level outputs. So my view is, and the government's view is, that the modern engines of service level productivity need to be turned up. Now, I think that cities, as I say, is right at the centre of that, and much of our service level productivity is now coming out of our major cities. If we look around the world, the world's greatest cities, the world's biggest cities, are unstoppable engines of growth. When you go to London nowadays, you barely move You can't buy a house. It's too unaffordable, but the place keeps growing. It's extraordinary. So something is happening there, which is creating economic opportunity, and there is no doubt in my mind that those big global cities are huge engines of economic growth. But likewise, the world's biggest cities and Australia's biggest cities are groaning under the weight of that growth. Housing seems unaffordable for all but the wealthiest. People travel mind-numbing distances between home and work. And that has a very, very big, not just economic impact, but I can tell you it has a big social impact as someone who represents those sorts of areas. And many of the families, often young families, in those regions really, really struggle. So we really need to focus on these issues if we are to enable higher levels of productivity. Now, central to all of this is that the service industries of the 21st century, the sorts of industries I've talked about, rely heavily on collisions of ideas, collaboration and competition. Economists like to call this a terrible word, which is agglomeration, but it's basically this collision of ideas, collaboration and competition. And Ed Glaser puts it well, a Harvard economist, when he says that ideas travel faster down streets and across corridors than they do across oceans and continents. Cities exist because that collision of people makes sense from an economic point of view. It's also exactly why productivity requires us to have great urban centres where people want to live and work. Now, part of getting that right for me is for us to start measuring it. And one of the things I've learned over the years in business and government is that it's surprising how quickly, when you start measuring something well, you start improving it. People start focusing on it. What's also clear to me is that if you can't measure it, it is very hard to get improvement. So that's why today we've launched our performance framework, which has key economic, social and environmental measures for the performance of our cities. This is not a Melbourne versus Sydney exercise. This is actually looking at the fingerprint of our cities, the DNA of our cities, and how we can improve them in areas like jobs and skills, infrastructure and investment, livability and sustainability, innovation and digital governance, planning and housing. And you'll see in the framework that we've released today a whole series of measures for consultation. We're looking for feedback on these measures for how we actually measure the performance of our cities. Now, one of my favourites, one of the Prime Minister's favourites, is whether or not we have a 30-minute city. And I think a 30-minute benchmark for our cities, for the distance between where someone lives and where they work and look for services, that benchmark, I think, tells us a lot. And in particular, we can see a trade-off in that data between accessibility and opportunity. Accessibility and opportunity. So at one extreme, we have our capital cities like Sydney, where we have the lowest proportion of accessible jobs at around 55%. So only about 55% of the people in Sydney with a job are actually living within 30 minutes of that job. Melbourne's next to Sydney at about 60%. But on the other hand, we have a whole series of regional cities that are at essentially 100%, like Toowoomba, Launceston, Geelong, Cairns and Bendigo. But, of course, the great challenge of those centres is they might be accessible, jobs might be accessible, but there's not enough jobs. And so we have these two groups, the spectrum of our cities, and in both cases we have real work to do. And by measuring this, I think we can start to get to the bottom of how to fix it. The 30-minute city idea was built from came from a phenomenon observed by a Venetian physicist called Marchetti, and it's now called Marchetti's constant. And I know a number of the urban planners in the room will know something of Marchetti's constant, but it's a concept that can be built into urban planning objectives. And I know the Greater Sydney Commission is actually doing just some outstanding work on thinking about Sydney as three cities, not one, because there's just no way, given the distance between the edges of southwestern Sydney, the extremities of Sydney, and the CBD, how we can ever make that into a 30-minute city. We simply can't. But what we can do is we can start building job centres or turning Sydney into a city with more than one job centre, with job centres out in the west around Badgerys Creek, the airport, Parramatta and the CBD itself. Now, the central tool for action for the federal government on our cities is something that we've unashamedly stolen, pilfered from the UK, which is city deals. It's a very simple idea, which is that whilst federalism has many advantages, one of its disadvantages is in solving problems quickly at the local level. But if we can get federal, state and local government working together, focused at that local level, we can solve a lot of our problems much faster. And that's what a city deal is. It's an agreement between the three levels of government, transparent commitments, transparent to all, to media, to citizens, to businesses, which are all designed to meet economic, social and environmental goals. We've signed the first two of our city deals in Launceston. We're very focused on helping Launceston in its journey towards becoming a genuine regional university city. Townsville, which is a much more industrial city, but has the potential to not only build more of that, but to attract tourism and education. And the third of our city deals that we're working on, and Sarah's involved with as well, is the Western Sydney city deal, which I've talked something of already. They're not just one-off projects. This is an approach which is designed to be a big, bold vision to create a shared direction for decades to come between the three levels of government. There'll be many more city deals. Ultimately, we've found that the demand far outstrips our ability to deliver outcomes, to deliver more city deals. But we do want to get it right, and we've made a very, very concerted effort in the first three city deals to make sure that they were exemplars that we could use as we go to the next round. So in summary, our cities really matter to national prosperity, I think, more than ever before. It is the job of governments not to create jobs, but to facilitate the creation of jobs within our cities, whether they be capital cities, suburban centres or regional centres. And I'm convinced that livable, productive and accessible cities will be the secret for success in the 21st century, and that's certainly what we're working towards. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and excellent time management there. So our next speaker... I'm also delighted to have Professor John Haskin-Deneau, who is a professorial fellow and deputy director of projects at the Melbourne Institute. A very strong publishing and academic record, has an educational background from Germany, and we invite you to speak. John.
Well, absolutely wonderful to be here today. Actually, when I was thinking of what to call my presentation, I was thinking actually in the terms of A Tale of Two Cities, and it'll become immediately apparent why that's the case. Coming up. Okay. So what I'll be talking to you today about is actually some of the topics that were just mentioned in ensuring that that our city structures are actually engines for job growth. And if you remember some of the topics that Prime Minister mentioned briefly in his lunchtime talk, were these sort of industrial transformations that were going on in cities like Geelong. And that's actually very central to what I'll be talking to you today about. Okay. Sorry. So slight technical problem here in the audiovisual. Oh, well, Murphy's Law, I guess. So the Prime Minister was talking about the industrial transformation, for instance, that was going on in the city of Geelong. And why actually the city of Geelong is particularly interesting is, of course, the industrial background of that city. And we know that city was also associated with the auto industry. And I guess the reason why I'm sort of focusing on a tale of two cities is because the two cities that I'm looking at are the greater metropolitan Melbourne and Adelaide cities, and for the obvious reason that they share this common denominator of their industrial profile, namely being from the auto industry. Let's have a look. Sorry. Looks like it's completely unresponsive. Oh, there's the mouse. That looks good. Looks like we're coming up.
Why is it up here, though?
Hmm.
Sorry, I can carry on. I can grab another laptop.
It's not touch screen. Let's see if I can. So this is not a clever ploy to get more FaceTime here on the podium. Trust me on this one. Does anyone know the keyboard F5? Yeah, there we go.
Are you seeing that?
Can you?
Okay.
Oh, okay, wonderful. Oh, that's fun. Fantastic. All right, so I can start. So you're all wondering, why is the big 91 up on the screen? And just to sort of to grab you a little bit, because there are 91 days until the last car rolls off the assembly line at the Holden plant in Elizabeth, South Australia, just so that everyone knows. The car industry has been in Australia for 100 years and has been concentrated in the metropolitan areas of Melbourne and Adelaide. In 91 days, not only will this facility close, but the entire industry will have shut down, displacing thousands of workers in assembly plants and their entire supply chain. So, thinking about the title of our conference, these people are clearly looking for new directions in an uncertain world. But this is clearly a Melbourne and Adelaide problem. I grew up in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, a city much like Geelong or Elizabeth, and I saw this firsthand with the collapse of the steel industry that was located there. And this steel industry fed into the Detroit car industry. I moved to Germany and was professor at the city of Bochum, which also closed their General Motors assembly operations. Finally, I moved to Australia, and here we are again. Geelong, Altona, Broadmeadows, Elizabeth. Some might say that the government should confiscate my passport just so that this path of destruction can finally be stopped. But seriously, the presentation is about the industry cluster surrounding the automotive industry, the employees being affected, and some of the possible solutions going forward for these industry centers in the cities. So this presentation is not intended to be a depressing story. This is intended to be a story of rebirth. And if we do this right, I believe Australia is well positioned to come out ahead. So what we're basically dealing with is how do we replace an industry that's been in these two main industrial cluster cities for 100 years? How can we replace that and match up with the kinds of profiles that we've seen already? Where to from here? Well, clearly the auto industry has been in trouble for quite some time. So for the last 45 years, the production in the auto industry has been in decline. And that's even with a highly productive labor force producing at even, you know, at very low cost, 92% of the comparable U.S. Worker. The problem is, of course, is that Australia is just simply geographically located far away. And even if we think about how Australia is slowly inching its way over to Asia, it will take some time before these costs of transport costs will become non-negligible. So it's clearly an area of decline. If we look at the top three car producers, Toyota, Holden, and Ford, what we immediately see is that the closure will occur by the end of this year, in fact, in October. And we're looking at displacing something like 7,000 employees in a very concentrated area, in the areas of metropolitan Melbourne and metropolitan Adelaide. So this is a city problem. This is a serious city problem. But not only is it the primary industry, but of course it's the entire supply chain. So the primary area, the supply chain, of course what we can expect are multiplier effects, and these are all concentrated in very, very small geographical areas. In fact, some of these supply chain providers can be as little as 300 meters away from the primary provider. So Lance Worrell and John Spohr tabled a report that basically showed that Australia was looking at the loss of something like 200,000 jobs net with the demise of the auto industry. And of course, that has large ramifications for the growth potential of Victoria and South Australia. And in fact, a lot of this stunting of growth is, of course, concentrated in areas that are very, very already sort of not so well off with respect to their industrial profile to begin with. So having spent most of my academic life in Germany, you get to sort of dealing with the issue of unemployment. And when I first came to Australia, people suggested I change my research agenda because I was told, actually, there isn't any unemployment here in Australia, and so that's a pretty much a pointless research agenda to have. Well, it's come back again. And so a lot of the knowledge that we have about unemployment and entry into unemployment, for instance, some work that I've done together with my co-author Sonia Kassenbermer, shows that it's very negative to people's self-esteem, very negative to people's subjective well-being, and this is what's going to happen to these areas in Melbourne and Adelaide. I got some wonderful information from the Holden Company about a survey of their current auto workers. And you know, leading up to the time that they will be displaced in the after Holden world. And I got some really, really interesting descriptive statistics from them. So these people have worked, of course, almost all their lives, and of course they want to continue working all their lives and working full time. Their education is predominantly, of course, high school, but they have lots of levels of certification. So these are employable people. These are skilled people. Not only do they have these skills, but of course they would love to be able to continue using their skills. And they're very open to the idea of expanding those skills into the IT area. So these are employable and wanting to sort of expand their skills. So I thought I needed to take a closer look at that. And so I got data from the Melbourne Institute's own HILDA panel, the Household Income, Labor, and Dynamics of Australia panel. And I looked at what's actually happening to the people in this industry over the last 15 years. So I got information from 2001 to 2015, both men and women, and I combined the industries of mining, manufacturing, and construction because I thought they would be very similar in profile, and looked at what's happening with employment, entry into unemployment, and re-entry into employment. Three things that came out of that mini study. So of the people who are currently not working, of those who have just entered into unemployment, I was looking at what's the probability that the last person job was in this sort of particularly interesting industry of mining, manufacturing, construction. And they're pretty much the same as any other industry. So they're not more likely to enter into unemployment than any other industry. And for instance, given that a person was in mining, manufacturing, and construction, in other words, that might fit into the auto worker area, what's the probability that a person is employed this period? It's only 0.2 of one percentage point lower. It's statistically significantly lower, but economically insignificantly lower. And then I want to know is, suppose that you were in this industry and you lost your job, what was the probability that you could re-enter that industry? Well, it was about half the people could re-enter that industry. But now with the demise of the auto industry in these two cities, of course, that probability is going to be much lower. So that's why I think policymakers really need to be active in this space, is that under normal conditions, people in this industry do well. But these are not normal times. Things are changing. So I thought I'd have a look and go visit the plant in Elizabeth, South Australia. And I was really happy to see that there were a lot of programs that the car company were offering, allowing people to gain the skills, either to go into business for themselves, gain additional IT skills, things along that line. But how do we make that sort of transition the best in these sort of two localized economies? Well, let's start thinking a little bit big. Let's just start thinking a little bit bigger than what we normally think. And let's start thinking about a growth industry that I'm going to call smarter energy. And I actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you some examples that are actually in action right now in Canada. And so I think Australia can learn from some of these Canadian examples. If you start to look at Australia's place in the world with respect to energy consumption, what you can see is that we use twice as much coal as the OECD average and far fewer renewables as compared to the OECD average. When you start to look at our greenhouse emissions, double that of the OECD average, and we're using energy on average much more than the OECD countries in general. And then when you start to look at how do we generate our electricity that we use for everyday life, you can actually find this up to the minute exact online. You can see for any state the sort of the energy mix, the energy source mix that's being used. What we're using is tons and tons and tons of black coal, and here in Victoria, unfortunately, brown coal, which is of course the dirtiest of them all. So the thing is that our energy use is something that of course needs to be addressed, and not just the amount, but then the mix. If you start to look at the price of coal, for instance, look at the volatility with respect to the price of coal. It can even increase its price by a factor of 10. And this is, of course, the engine of electricity production here in Australia. But this is the kind of volatility that we're exposed to. If you look at the volatility in the price of natural gas, it's very similar. What you see is, of course, across the board, the price of producing solar-based energy is consistently dropping and dropping in a very predictable manner. This is particularly interesting, and I'll show you in a minute, to the cities of Melbourne and Adelaide. I had a look at the national energy market. It's the biggest energy market in the world if you start to look at the distance in the power lines. And for most households, they're making their energy consumption decisions based on maybe one or two price points, in other words, peak or off-peak. But in the wholesale market, what we're looking at is a whole bunch of five-minute spot markets where price can fluctuate dramatically. As we all know, what's happened in the last year, a heat wave, say in the city of Sydney, can spike the prices dramatically. Can go from something like $100 per megawatt hour to $12,000 per megawatt hour, and we have to be able to somehow incorporate these costs. If you start to look at, for instance, the energy market in Victoria, what you can see is the green line. You can see a very nice, smooth, easily predictable demand. But what, of course, you see also is the highly volatile wholesale price. And these are in 5-minute spot markets. The same thing that we can see for South Australia. This is a Melbourne, this is an Adelaide issue. Let's find how we can look at ways in which we can implement this new smarter energy industry that will allow us the growth industry that we once had, say, with the automobile industry, allow us to regain some of these jobs. And of course, at the same time, we get some clean air, we get investments in education and human capital and know-how in this industry. This is happening right now in real time. Let's have a look at Toronto. This is actually happening in real time, in which this industry is growing such that what we're doing is, here in Toronto, what we're doing is we're putting lithium ion batteries up telephone poles. And in the evening, when there's excess supply of electricity, we're siphoning it off, we're storing it in these batteries, and then integrating them into the supply for the next day. This is happening in real time right now in Toronto. The same thing can be happened with half megawatt racks, where you just sort of decentralize, place all these things in the city. Well, what does that have to do with Melbourne and Adelaide? We could be doing exactly the same thing. The same kinds of people the same kind of profile sets of skill sets of what people could be doing or were doing in the automobile industry, these are the same kinds of skill sets these people could be doing in this new industry of smarter energy. Servicing these racks of lithium-ion batteries and providing this additional supply to the grid. I saw this firsthand in Toronto. In fact, the people who are working on these sites were people who were directly out of the GM auto industry in Toronto that had been previously laid off. So the skill set is right. The skill set I know is right. And these are development possibilities that we can be taking advantage of. So what are the next steps? Well, of course, there's been a lot of movement in the coal industry. There's been all this sort of development in high-efficiency, low-emission coal, carbon capture, and that's ways of course, addressing our energy issues. That's clearly not enough. And so what we need to do to get this industry going is to be clustering our know-how. And clustering our know-how in these areas of competence in Melbourne and Adelaide. And one way in which we can do that is by fostering the use of lithium-ion storage. So what we really need to make sure that this industry survives is we need to build a consortium. We need to build a consortium of interested parties that includes international car companies, mining companies, areas of research such as the universities, CSIRO, and the ARC, and state and commonwealth government. Why would a mining company be interested in investing in this? These big five mining companies, of course, should be interested in it. It should be in their own interest because at some point, coal is just simply going to be a far too dirty an energy source to be using. So we need to be moving into this area, making these investments, and replacing the old industries that we've had in Melbourne and South Australia. I'm not sure if everyone's aware of what's going on. Tesla is building the new gigafactory in Nevada to produce lithium-ion batteries on a scale that has never been seen before in this entire world. In fact, this production facility will add to the total global production of lithium-ion batteries by factors of 2, 3, and maybe more. And so what does this mean? It means that the price of storage of electricity has gone so far down that we can actually begin to use this electrical storage as a key factor in this new smarter energy industry. We all heard this month, in fact, of the new announcement of the facility that's being established in Jamestown, South Australia, north of Adelaide. A combination of lithium-ion batteries to store electricity coupled with wind energy to generate that electricity. These are possibilities for investments in know-how, investments in this industry, jobs, and growth. In fact, this week what we found was the Victorian government announcing a similar kind of a setup with solar energy and lithium-ion battery storage to power up all the trams in Melbourne. Similar kinds of investments being made in Bendigo. And even what we heard most fantastic was actually just this week is a new production facility in Dandenong in Greater Melbourne, which looked at the production of electric trucks. This is just happening just this week. This is incredibly exciting as to these new developments. But this clearly won't be enough just to allow these few small developments to happen. What the Prime Minister, for instance, in his lunchtime talk talked about these carbon rims that are being made in Geelong. That's a great development, but that certainly won't be enough, and that's something that we'll have to be addressing, fostering, and adding to that industry. Let's face it, Australia is the sunniest place on Earth. There's no two ways about it. And if we can't make solar energy work here in Melbourne or in Adelaide, we can't make it work anywhere in the world. And certainly anywhere further north, there's just such an abundance of sunshine. All of this work, of course, is prefaced on the ability to translate sunshine into some sort of electrical energy. And all of this work is being done, for instance, at the Centre of Excellence Hub in Exciton Science. Here at the University of Melbourne, also Monash University, we're looking at new materials to efficiently translate the sun's energy into electricity. This is happening here in these two cities, the tale of two cities. So what I'm looking at is a win-win situation of investing in Melbourne and Adelaide, keeping the employment up where we had before, keeping the know-how and the jobs here, and making sure that, of course, we're addressing our national clean energy targets, making sure that our greenhouse gases are reduced, and certainly getting much, much cleaner air. And, of course, what do we gain from this? Actually, a much more stable energy supply, much more abundance of energy, and all of this is, of course, completely compatible with the Finkel Review. So what do we gain? Well, we get zero emissions from all of the lithium-ion batteries that we use. We get zero emissions from all the solar and wind energy that we use. We get zero emissions from all these electrical cars. And, of course, for our grid stability, we get zero response time for electricity supply. We can react very dynamically for that. And let's just face it, petrol cars and diesel cars are on their way out. We have zero time to waste. In fact, what we need to do on all levels of government and all levels of industry, we need to be acting now. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed, John. And our final speaker is Ms. Sarah Hill, who was the 2016 Australian Planner of the Year, a recognised leader in the planning of communities, and she comes to us as the CEO of the Greater Sydney Commission. Sarah.
Now, as the anchor today, I'm conscious you've probably been sitting down for a while after lunch. If you want to stand up for a minute as we transition, please feel free to. It's always good for your back. Otherwise, I'm ready to rock by the looks of it, which is good. That's the way, good people down the back, look after your backs. That's good. So if John today talked about a tale of two cities, I'm now going to talk about a metropolis of three cities, being Greater Sydney. And I'm going to share with you a little bit of the story of the Greater Sydney Commission, which is a new independent organisation within Greater Sydney. And a little bit of our story and the work that we're doing to not only improve the productivity of Greater Sydney, but its livability and its sustainability. And I'm afraid I'm a person who can't keep still very well, so I'm going to walk around a little bit as I talk through my talk today. Is this on okay? Yep, great. So as I said, we're a new organisation that was established last year to better coordinate and integrate the planning of Greater Sydney, and not only from a land use point of view, but from an infrastructure point of view and from a timing and sequencing point of view, drawing together all of the elements across state government, but also working very closely with local government. And that is absolutely critical to the things that we've been doing. And our architecture is very much designed to achieve that. So we have a commission that includes the Secretaries of Treasury, Transport, Planning, Health and Education. We have four commissioners, a Chief Commissioner, as well as a Commissioner for Economic, Social and Environmental Issues. And we have six District Commissioners, each who have been nominated by the six districts of Greater Sydney, which are effectively made up of groups of local governments. So we're a well-represented board and certainly one with much knowledge. And as I said, one of our key remits or components of our legislation is to improve Greater Sydney's, livability, productivity and sustainability. Absolutely key integrated factors. And this very much draws on the diagram that I have here and very much to the Minister's point about the importance of a good, strong economy to support the success of a city, to in turn support the strength of a good social community and in turn to protect the environment. And we see those three key components of our legislation interlinked. And as luck would have it, actually, on Monday, we released a document called Directions for a Greater Sydney. It was one that we created in collaboration with other state government agencies to set the direction for Greater Sydney. And in fact, to give greater certainty to not only our communities, but to industry in terms of the direction that we were heading. And these 10 directions really is not something that people are going to argue with or contest, but really they lay the foundation for the work that we're doing. And what's really different about what we're doing at the moment in Greater Sydney is for the first time we're going to have an integrated land use, transport and infrastructure plan and strategy all together operating off these 10 directions to give that greater certainty of direction, to give that greater foundation for Sydney going forward. Now, Sydney, as we know, has some incredible opportunities. A phenomenal level of growth has occurred, strong population growth, record levels of infrastructure to leverage from. And certainly we have some key industries of growth across the city in health and education and finance. Some incredible opportunities. But with great opportunities also comes challenges. And over time, our city will grow substantially. And certainly, like Melbourne, we are going to almost double in size. And with that growth comes growing demand for not only housing, but infrastructure. And also great concerns from the community about how this will play out and how we can keep the things we love about Greater Sydney whilst also achieving those outcomes. And as some of those numbers show, we estimate we need between 725,000 and 825,000 more dwellings in the next 20 years. Now, to put that into perspective, we have 1.7 million dwellings in Greater Sydney at the moment. So that's quite a substantial increase. We already have significant challenges with housing affordability, and we certainly need additional jobs going forward to support that growth. And so when we started the commission, we wanted to do some research about cities. Cities that grow rapidly, and cities that double in size. And so we looked to an academic in the US who had done some analysis, some research about what happens when a city grows, and indeed, what happens when a city doubles in size. And this academic found four key laws, which I will just touch on briefly. The first one is improved efficiency. As a city doubles, we can get better efficiency out of our utilities and infrastructure. As a city doubles, we can also improve productivity through what the Minister was referring to early, benefits of agglomeration and clustering and so forth. And in effect, he estimated it was about a 15% gain through that process. The third law is generally with population growth, jobs track with a steady proportion with that increase. And the fourth is, as a city doubles in size, generally challenges around crime and social challenges tend to increase. And that's obviously something that we need to be very mindful of as part of that wheel or that set of directions. To look forward, we also need to look back. And so here is a dotted history of plans, of region plans, overarching directions for Greater Sydney. The top left is a beautiful old document. It's a 1909 report by a commission that was prepared into Sydney's future. And so we like to look back on that as a commission in 2017 to see really what's changed, what stays the same, and really what's come full circle. What we've found from looking at that is that some things haven't changed. Housing continues to be a key challenge. Although in 1909 we had challenges about sanitation and moving workers out of the city, back in 2017, housing affordability has become a key issue. We also find that traffic congestion, believe it or not, back in 1909 was a hot topic. And certainly there was strong recognition of the need for more trains and better infrastructure across the city. And in 1909, they were very keen to beautify the city, modelling it off the Parisian boulevards of Europe and trying to build on Sydney as a harbour city. Some things have certainly changed. Dwelling occupancy rates back then were about 5 to 6 persons per dwelling, depending on where you lived. Today, obviously, far lower than that. Other elements certainly have come full circle back to the need and the importance of a green grid, or a web, as they called it, a green web in 1948, as well as the importance of cities, and as I said again, back to the critical need for sustainable transport, trams and light rail and so forth. And so here we have an early version of Greater Sydney, just showing the incredible focus that it had around an eastern city. And unlike Melbourne, we're a city that's focused around an eastern seaboard at present. And everything in its history, in the history of Sydney, has tried to radiate in and out of that eastern CBD that we often, you know, recognise for with the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House. But of course, as our city grows, we have to reshape it. And our contribution to the productivity of Sydney is not just through policy, but it is through reshaping the city. Reshaping it, redesigning it to get better efficiency and gains out of it. And so our approach is to refocus the city across a metropolis of 3 cities. And as Minister Taylor also referred to, we are very strongly focused around this principle of a 30-minute city. This graph here shows what an incredible aspiration that is. These are my 6 districts along the bottom here. And this graph shows average access, 30-minute access, morning peak hour to a key centre, a job centre. And you can see just the incredibly low levels and certainly the challenges to the southwest, the west and the south in particular. This is very much driving our refocus around 3 cities. So the eastern city, where the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House is this blue area that we refer to as the eastern city. Refocusing Sydney around Greater Parramatta, which certainly since 1968 has been heralded as the second CBD of Sydney and is really just coming into fruition now. And then on to our future, or our next generation city, around the airport being an absolute catalyst and game changer for Western Sydney, and reinforcing and backing in many of the existing centres there that have been strong centres for literally hundreds of years, but a challenge with that diversity of jobs and that diversity of outcome. Why is this important? Well, quite frankly, from the area, the red area in the middle, we are going to see an additional 1.5 million people move into this area in the next 20 years. Phenomenal job, phenomenal housing growth, phenomenal growth and demand for jobs. But at the moment, we have a city that is still very much structured around radiating into the blue area. We need to refocus and rebalance Greater Sydney to be able to achieve those changes. And that's very much the focus of the work that we are doing now around a metropolis of 3 cities. And so I'm going to tempt fate now and tempt the IT skills and see if we can run a bit of a video about the directions that we're heading in. Our 10 directions, which we launched on Monday, are a prelude to a region plan that we are preparing for Greater Sydney to present to the government later this year. And the intention is very much to reshape and refocus Greater Sydney, working with our colleagues in state government in transport, with infrastructure, New South Wales, health and education. So here's a little bit of the story. Let's see how we go.
Greater Sydney, world-class and successful, is a growing city. With 8 million residents forecast by 2056, the Greater Sydney Commission is committed to a more productive, livable and sustainable city. That means more homes, more jobs and new schools, along with new roads and public transport in the right places. After engaging with thousands of Greater Sydneysiders, the Commission has developed Directions for a Greater Sydney. These are the integrated directions for Greater Sydney's future planning. Greater Sydney is a city for people, a collaborative city with the right infrastructure, more jobs and skills for growth, a well-connected city with affordable housing. Greater Sydney will be a city of great places for work and play, making the most of its enviable landscape, efficient in its use of resources, and resilient to technological and climate change. The people of Sydney have told us they want growth matched by the right infrastructure at the right time. That's why Directions for a Greater Sydney will be reflected in the New South Wales State Government's major land use, transportation and infrastructure plans in 2018. The government can then strategically plan investments, projects and priorities. Communities and investors will have clarity on the delivery of new homes, schools and hospitals, as well as public transport, roads and green spaces, not to mention the services, jobs and skills to sustain them. Directions for a Greater Sydney provides a collaborative way of planning for our future. For more information, connect with the Greater Sydney Commission online.
So certainly something in there for everyone, and it's certainly an integrated approach to our city. I'm going to draw down just on four of the directions in brief now, just to explain them a little bit further. And this map here is a bit of a passion of mine. One of the things I was really keen to do at the Greater Sydney Commission is to put all on one page the activity of housing growth and change that's happening across the city. And you'll see the dark purple areas are state-led areas of innovation, growth centres, urban transformation areas, urban renewal corridors, land and housing corporation areas. And then you'll see what we call the measles is very much the private sector response and how that very, very much complements the work that the state government is doing in integrating those areas. And you'll see the incredible change that's occurring across Sydney and the importance that that has, obviously, to the infrastructure balance as well that I referred to earlier. This map really clearly shows some of the challenges we have as well, though, where we're creating incredible capacity for housing opportunities in the Western City, but still we need to refocus and rebalance that with the jobs. And certainly there's a whole underlying story to housing and housing affordability across Greater Sydney that I could talk for hours on, but I won't today. The second one is about improving the productivity, jobs and skills for the city. And across each of the three cities, our region plan will have a sub-story for each of the core policy areas. This being a key sub-story for the Eastern City as a finance, professional services, fintech and health and education cluster. The Central City is a health and education area of excellence focused around Westmead, one of the world-leading areas of health research. Administration, finance and business services hub. And as I referred to earlier, the critical importance of the airport, the city deal, for ensuring a game changer in terms of jobs and opportunities around manufacturing, tourism, logistics, advanced health, education and science, all critical components of trying to balance out the opportunities that the Minister referred to across Greater Sydney. We heard loud and clear from 13-year-olds through to 87-year-olds when Lucy and I have been out talking to people over the last 18 months about the critical importance of aligning infrastructure with growth. There is more of a comfort with growth if we can see the outcomes with that. So our plan will have a series of steps and a series of mechanisms to better align infrastructure with that growth. And one of the concepts we released on Monday is called a Growth Infrastructure Compact, an idea, an initiative of the Chief Commissioners, Lucy Turnbull, to very much tie together housing opportunities with all of that infrastructure. And I'm not just talking about roads and rail. I'm referring to health and education and community facilities, open space and playing fields, all of the things that our communities look for. And I think I'll end, importantly, on this last direction of a city of great places. We see our city as a mosaic of places, and I think from a productivity point of view, the importance of in creating great places to attract world-class businesses, to attract the right type of skills and employment are absolutely critical, and we can't overplay that enough. And last but not least, if you are interested in learning more, have a look on our website for a copy of Directions or the Growth Compact. But I'll also just flag the importance of information to creating certainty. And we've launched a new data hub as well as a means to better provide information about the city, to benchmark it, and very much to the Minister's point, to be able to track and change the effect of our plans over time, an area I'm particularly passionate about. And each of our 10 directions, therefore, have a metric within the plan that we'll be measuring over time. Thank you.
Okay, so we've now got a few minutes for questions. Straight over to you all. And we have a microphone. All right. Yes.
I'm just interested in a couple of the specific things that can be done to actually deliver this 30-minute city, which is a fantastic undertaking because it's kind of makes a lot of sense intuitively, but in terms of delivering it, pretty difficult, very difficult. So do you have any specific ideas, levers?
Yeah. So I'll make an initial comment because I know Sarah thinks a lot about this as well. To me, there's three broad categories. One is more houses close to where there are already jobs. The second, which typically means density and density around transport hubs more than anything, and transport hubs and job centres. We haven't done that particularly well in Australia. I think we're getting better at it. Sydney in particular is getting better at it. Melbourne's starting to get the hang of it, but we've got a long way to go on that. It's not that hard, but you've got to integrate transport with planning. And you've got to get over this sort of NIMBYism of moving from low density to higher density. The second piece is having better connection between home and jobs. That's the one we've traditionally focused on, particularly with roads. I mean, but there's a limit. You can invest billions and billions and billions of dollars every year, and if that's the only lever you're pulling, I don't think you're ultimately going to solve the problem. And then the third lever is the one that Sarah was just talking about, which is more jobs closer to where people are living, which means polytypic for Sydney at least. And I would argue in time, I think, for Melbourne, you need to have a polycentric city. You've got to have major job centres beyond just the eastern CBD. Now, all three of those things, we are doing all three right now. There's different initiatives. I won't labour each of the initiatives that's designed around it, but the really obvious one on the third one is Badgerys Creek Airport. Airports are job magnets, and so we've got to use it. We've got a great opportunity working with the state government in New South Wales, for instance, and I think that's an initiative in particular in Sydney that will make a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we have thought about long and hard, and it is an incredible challenge. It's an aspiration. I very much see it as an aspiration and a very good aspiration to have. The Minister's quite right in that our international research shows that cities do reach a certain size, that they tip over to the point that they need a second CBD or in fact a third, and that polycentric approach is not a new one to Greater Sydney, but we really have to invest to really flip the focus. And in fact, right down to our planning, we always look west to east rather than east to west, which is a traditional way that Sydney's thought. Now, I often think in layers in cities, and for us, in answer to your question, it is about getting the right bits of infrastructure at a big picture level, at that macro level of better infrastructure across the entire city, servicing a population the size of several Adelaides in Western Sydney, and to do that fairly in a connected way. It is refocusing the city around the heart of Parramatta. But it really comes down to layers after layers, down to the neighbourhood level. And 30-minute city, we often debate this. Is it walking? Is it by car? Is it by public transport? And in fact, it's all of those elements, but it's to different levels of services as well. It's not just jobs, it's school, it's health, and it's education. And the more that we can leverage off that to be able to redesign the city from the ground up, that's where we get excited. And as I said, one of the concepts we love is a city of mosaics, and that, you know, there's lots of different exciting and rich components of the city that interlink together. Not everywhere has to be the same, but it needs to be in building blocks to address, you know, the challenges we have.
Thanks. Mark Cully from the Industry Department in Canberra. Questions primarily for the Minister, but it kind of goes across the panel. I guess I was expecting you to wear both of your hats today and to talk about what opportunities digital transformation provides for cities, both on the kind of productivity and livability side, and it looks like it's a little bit missing from the document that's been published today as well. And I would think there's all sorts of opportunities. If we think about transport, around user pricing, about the ability to use the data to kind of charge very precisely. We look at John's stuff that he was doing around electricity, around how we're using smart meters and so on. So I just maybe get you to elaborate on the opportunities that are there.
So what we published today was outcomes, not inputs. I am a massive believer in the importance of technology as an input to deliver more, better outcomes with less, more with less, which in this modern era for government is incredibly important. But if we think of technology as an outcome, I think we get it wrong. I've always believed this. So if the outcome we're looking for in transport is to move people faster, more conveniently from A to B, that's great. That's a good objective for transport. It's not the only one, but it's an important one. Technology is a way to achieve that. And so there's lots we're doing on digital. If I had another 20-minute speech, I could talk about that. There's a Smart Cities and Suburbs program. I encourage you to have a look at it. But, you know, to me, it is very easy to get in the trap of thinking of technology as an output. It is an input to the outcomes you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I think it's really important to keep in mind also that, you know, the actual clustering of industries in specific areas is greatly facilitated by increased digital connections. So the thing is, the idea of clustering is that, you know, 1 + 1 = 3, and to try to get sort of synergy effects between different component parts in the industry, whether it's sort of supply chain or the production. And of course, this digital technology allows that to happen much quicker. So I think it's an integral part of our city planning and how this growth can happen.
Thank you. Yeah, just building on those comments as well, and thank you for your comments and presentations earlier today. My name is Sander van Amersfoort. I'm with the committee for Melbourne. One of the things you spoke about in your speech earlier, Minister, about the importance of cities these days and how we should think about Australia, not simply as a collection of states. And particularly larger cities, and to Sarah's point earlier about long-term planning, mid-century cities of 8 million, we're dealing with these things as well. Particularly in that context, the uncertainty around digital transformation and more widely the fourth industrial revolution that will profoundly change the way we live, work, do business, attract investment, et cetera, et cetera. We at the Committee for Melbourne had looked at some scenarios for Melbourne in the context of the fourth industrial revolution, and we were lucky enough to have the Minister at our launch. One of the key things that we found as well is there's a piece of research that's already a decade old, but looked at the size of mega regions. And those are those integrated sets of cities with the suburban hinterlands across which you can move capital and labor quite easily. and very efficiently. And actually what we found is already 10 years ago, the top 40 mega regions in the world, so you're talking Boston, New York, Washington corridors, or Amsterdam, Brussels, Paris, you name it, the top 40 mega regions in the world already 10 years ago were had only 18% of the world's population, but two-thirds of global economic output and 90%, 90, of patented innovation. Australia, obviously, because of its geography, doesn't have a mega region. But I'd like to make that observation and channel it out there to the audience and to the panel here about what are some of the things that we should be starting to think about when we start competing on a global stage. And an incredible premium is placed on innovation where those things are happening. So it's something that I think the capital cities and on a federal level, we should really start also getting our heads around. What does that mean for Australia in terms of its ability to compete in the next decades to come? Thank you.
Well, it's an interesting one, actually, because our boundary starts and ends at a certain point as an organisation, and increasingly, as we get into our work, we're realising that there's a whole, you know, broader world out there, and the Committee for Sydney is, in fact, doing a piece of work about joining Wollongong, Newcastle and Sydney together, and you know, these are ideas that have often been played with about the benefits of the broader region. And so what we're really focusing on at the moment is recognising the incredible importance of those interconnections and how we can strengthen them, and that the city really can't survive as an island. It has to have those broader benefits, absolutely key to that. And just simple elements such as Central Coast being a key affordable area that brings and allows access into our city for a broader range of workers. But I think, interestingly for us, there's a real game changer happening with the airport in Western Sydney, which will ultimately be one of the most connected, I'd argue the most connected areas in Australia in terms of road, rail and obviously flight. So I think there's some incredible opportunities there to think outside the square. Once we finish a few elements we need to work on in the next few months, we're very keen to.
Okay, I think we have the last question coming up from the rear.
Thanks. My name's Edward Smelt from Infrastructure Victoria. I've got a quick question for Sarah. I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit on the infrastructure connection with growth and whether you're anticipating some sort of minimum service levels or sort of trigger points for investment in rail and education and the like.
Great question, actually, because it's occupying a lot of our time. Can I start by saying what's been absolutely critical to us, and people often wonder, you know, ask me what's the sort of most surprising thing in setting up the commission, you know, what am I most surprised about? We've had incredible buy-in from other state government agencies just recognising the critical role, A, for a vision in this space and for clear direction about how the city will change. We work with Infrastructure New South Wales on a daily, hourly basis sometimes, and as they're preparing the review of their strategy and we're preparing our plan, we're entirely swapping notes and working together. Transport for New South Wales moved their offices to Parramatta, the central city where we're based, so that they can work with us. Absolutely key. So that's just from a kind of collaboration point of view, but from a growth compact point of view, we have a very simple idea, a method, an approach that we're getting buy-in across all of state government that, A, looks at really where opportunities for growth are across the city. It models scenarios for change. It works off benchmarks for existing capacity, or identifies what existing capacity is, what future requirements there are. And then effectively it looks at different funding and financing mechanisms to see really where the gaps are and what how we can better layer contributions to funding that. But the thing that most excites me about the Growth Compact is, for the first time, we'll be identifying across the city and benchmarking different areas so we can understand really where the most efficient and effective places are for growth and change, and really where it's not a great government investment or good industry investment to focus on. Where's the low-hanging fruit? Where's the best bang for buck? And better understanding that, rather than trying to upzone an entire city and provide infrastructure concurrently.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank the speakers for their excellent contributions, and thank you all for your participation.
Thank you.